May I have the entry expenses, please? Thank you, Ms. Montanya.
Gregory Piché, on behalf of Cherokee, along with Peter Johnson and Heather Joyce.
Your Honor, Wayne Shore for Bridge Service Department.
All right, thank you. Ms. Montanya and Mr. Piché, are you going to be doing the entirety of the arguments on your sides?
I'm going to reserve, ma'am, 10 minutes for Lydia's presentation. Bridge is somewhat the same, but also.
Sure, you may do so. I just want to tell you that you'll be happily in charge of your own management of time, and you'll be able to see very clearly how the time is working its way down. Ms. Montanya?
I will do the oral argument. If the court has specific questions that you want them to answer to, Ms. Thompson has represented the district as a primary counsel from the year. If it is appropriate, she could answer those questions.
Very good. And once again, you should reserve any time that you wish for a rebuttal argument. You'll have to keep track of your own time. Okay, this is a 1 hour case, which means that each side, as a total, you each have a half an hour that you need to manage. So whenever you're ready, you can go ahead and start, please. Thank you.
I'm ready. This case is an appeal from a judgment of the Water Court in Water Division 2. The setting is a designated groundwater basin east of the city of Colorado Springs. The Upper Black Squirrel District was designated in 1968, and the Management District was created in 1979. The water supply is fully provided from the groundwater aquifer. The Management District is often referred to as UBS, and I'll refer to them as that today. They are charged with management and protection of the groundwater aquifer. Cherokee Meridian are two water districts who provide water service both inside and outside of the basin. This basin is over-appropriated. That means there are more claims to water than there is water to satisfy those claims. There is and has been for decades an atmosphere of water scarcity in this basin. To be clear concerning the issue of water scarcity, this case is not about the need for water. People who live within the basin rely on their wells for their domestic water for their businesses, for their homes. And we also understand that the two water districts, Cherokee and Meridian, need water for their customers as well. The specific appeal here is from the water court below construing paragraph 5 of a stipulation and release. The UBS district brought a declaratory judgment action before that court in the water court seeking a ruling concerning paragraph 5 of the stipulation and release. Paragraph 5 provides its entitled recharge, and it says Cherokee will use its best efforts to deliver wastewater returns. Then it lists the number of subdivisions and any other subdivisions it serves back into the Upper Black Squirrel Creek designated basin for recharge of the aquifer. Cherokee shall recharge any wastewater returns from the Sunset Plant into the aquifer. Sunset Plant is within the basin. Cherokee now contends that this provision and the words for recharge of the aquifer allow it to claim all water that's recharged on a one-for-one basis as credit in a replacement.
Can I ask you just a couple of factual questions?
Yes.
The recharge water is solely wastewater treatment plant return flows, is that correct?
Yes. Cherokee has a wastewater treatment plant, and it services other districts treating their wastewater. And so, yes, all of those are wastewater.
Okay. Did those appropriations at any time have the right to fully consume the return flows?
This is a fundamental issue we're going to get to later, but let's touch on it now. The Cherokee water rights, which are the Sweetwater wells, are not adjudicated for replacement or for augmentation. That was a fundamental problem that Judge Schwartz didn't understand. The parties could not have intended that the water be fully consumed in this way, because the Sweetwater rights were never adjudicated for that. And as we know, water rights are usufructory rights. They're rights of use. And those uses have to be specifically requested in an application. The application has to be published. The court has to review those and grant those rights.
Okay, so that's Hornbrook Native Basin Appropriation Law.
I'm sorry.
That's Hornbrook Native Appropriation Basin Law that you can only make one use. Correct?
That's right.
Okay, but what? But this is designated groundwater. Does that native one-use principle apply in a designated groundwater basin?
Yes, it does.
Why?
It does because that's just the law in this area. Designated groundwater is not different on the one-use rule.
Because it's modified prior appropriation, and that still means prior appropriation?
Yes, and because the return flows are what others rely on for their water rights. It's the same as under the Balance of the Water Rights Determination and Administration Act. If there is no return flow, and every water right fully consumes 100%, then there's no water for the other appropriators. And as I said, this is a basin of water scarcity. And that fundamental fact is one of the reasons that the construction that Judge Schwartz gave to paragraph 5, frankly, doesn't make any sense.
And that's because the water belongs back in the public domain. It belongs back in the water system. And so your concern is recharge should simply mean since you don't own the return flows, you don't have the right to reuse them. You're putting them back in this designated basin.
That's right.
That's what you think this says.
That's exactly right. It says recharge the aquifer. Now, it doesn't have a laundry list of things that you can't do. It doesn't say, and by the way, you can't do, and then have a whole list of things. Because the way water rights are decreed is you get a right of use, and you have to say what your right of use is. You have to prove that you need that water for that particular use, or else it's speculation, which also applies in designated basins. We don't have that here. The Sweetwater water rights, we have all these things that starts with S, and so I have to think about that. The Sweetwater water rights were not adjudicated for augmentation or for replacement. We brought that to Judge Schwartz's attention in a request for rehearing on his order, and
So if this was an imported water, there'd be no question that you could claim credit for the return flows.
If this was water from the Colorado River, it would be different because that water comes over the Continental Divide. That was the Thornton case that you can consume it 100%. This is water that travels about 20 miles in a pipeline between the designated basin and where the wastewater treatment plant is. And if you look at some of the underlying letters, one from Mr. Susnell, who was representing Cherokee at that time, he talks about the fact, now in his opinion, this would have been one of the first times that water was returned to the basin for the purposes of recharge, and he says it will greatly benefit the black squirrel, I think is what he calls it. So he recognizes that that recharge has to be returned. Now later, Cherokee sued him for malpractice, and one of their allegations is that they didn't tell him, that he didn't tell them, that they had to go to UVS and get approval to export that water. So they claimed that they didn't know and that it was his responsibility to tell them. So the fact that there had to be an export order with terms and conditions is just the law.
So one final factual question. Any of these water sources that are being brought in through these intergovernmental agreements, are any of them imported water where you have the right to make a reuse of it?
There is no imported water where you have a right to make a reuse. Now there is some non-trib water, and one of the concerns was, well, is non-trib water designated groundwater? The legislature says it is, and it is. Whether you agree or disagree with that rationale, I guess it's not for us to decide, but non-trib water is designated groundwater as well.
Only because the designated basin overlays this non-tributary formation, correct?
That's right.
And this,
the non-trib water is within the basin, therefore it is designated water.
Okay.
And subject to the same rules.
Could I ask you just one sort of procedural question here, or really scope of this ruling? What's
right.
at issue here?
Okay.
I was going to say, does the ruling purport to grant to be a decree in any way and grant the Cherokee the right to do something, or, and it was hard for me to tell looking, or does it simply deal with what the limits of the stipulation are and say this stipulation has nothing to do with whether they could get credit for this water in a different degree.
Well, you might notice in the record, Judge May said this isn't ambiguous the first time. That was our first water judge. He said it's clear. This is to recharge the aquifer. End of discussion. Judge Schwartz said, well, because it doesn't say you can do something in this stipulation, then I guess they can use it for recharge. We read that as granting another beneficial use, clearly outside of kind of fundamental water law. He says it can be done. And if you affirm that, then how am I supposed to go back and say it can't be done? It is a fundamental problem with the way that this was handled, is that the judge, I guess you could say by silence or by negative implication, says because there wasn't a laundry list of things in the stipulation saying that the water rights couldn't be used for this, I guess you can use them for that. And that's the order that we appeal from. We think it's a fundamental error here.
And without regard to the merits, then the way this affects you, as you see it, is then if Cherokee goes and seeks another decree for replenishment or augmentation or whatever, you're going to be bound by Judge Schwartz's determination that they're entitled to get credit for this recharge water.
That's exactly how this came up. There was a pending replacement plan in front of the Groundwater Commission. The hearing began, and when it became clear that they were seeking to use this water as credit on a one-for-one basis, it was agreed by the parties, and it's in the hearing officer's order that the parties agreed to stay that proceeding, to go back to Water Division 2. And UBS filed before Water Division 2 and said, wait a minute, we need an interpretation of this paragraph 5, because it doesn't make sense to spend all of the resources, experts, attorney time, and all of that hearing this replacement plan when the water can't be used for that purpose. So it's exactly as you say. If I get an order from this court that says, well, I guess they can use it for that purpose, then go back into the replacement plan hearing, and all of a sudden we have a new beneficial use that was never published, never applied.
And apropos of your answer to Justice Hobbs about the purposes for which the Sweetwater is wells are adjudicated, do you take Judge Schwartz's order as ignoring that, or simply saying, I'm not dealing with that? That may be another reason why they can't have credit, or they can't get this replenishment plan or whatever. But that has nothing to do with this stipulation.
It has everything to do with the stipulation, and he knew well, he just made a mistake, that that's exactly what was going on. Now, Judge Mays, who was the seasoned water judge, who had heard days of testimony in a prior case, as you know, this has been before the court on numerous occasions, said that's not what it means. You put the water in the aquifer, you leave it there. You can't put it in one pocket and take it out the other and say, well, we comply. No, that's not what's going on. By the time this went back on remand after Meridian intervened, we had a new water judge. And so we got the first water judge went this way, the second water judge went that way, and here we are. So that's exactly the problem, is that we will wind up with a replacement plan with water from these Sweetwater wells that apparently can be used for replacement, even though it's, in my view, fundamentally wrong. And we don't believe that recharge of the aquifer, that language is vague at all. I wanted to bring to the court's attention that in a prior opinion from this court, there is a paragraph in that opinion that explains when the issue came up with regard to another provision in that stipulation, and it was the use of wells 1 to 8 for emergency and backup purposes. Just a quote from your opinion. Examining the plain language of the provision, it is clear that the primary purpose of the provision is to restrict the use of wells 1 to 8 to supplying only those portions of the Cherokee District that are within the designated basin, so that unused water will be recharged into the aquifer. Those are your words. They were not ambiguous in the opinion, and they're not ambiguous in paragraph 5 of this stipulation. We intended it to mean the same thing. So why are we here? We have a mixed case of contract construction issue and water law issues. Principles of contract construction say paragraph 5 is to be read as part of the document as a whole. There are numerous limitations in that paragraph when you look at that stipulation. There's the emergency and backup one that's been here before. There's limitations on yield. There's limitations on time to make absolute. There's monitoring and reporting requirements. And then there is this provision, which is consistent with those other paragraphs. And it's another principle of contract construction to look and give effect to every word. This provision wasn't boilerplate. It's not a fill-in-the-form kind of provision. These words were crafted specifically for this situation. And so we believe recharge to the aquifer means just what it says, that those wastewater returns are to be put into the aquifer and left there.
Well, the plain meaning of recharge, for example, natural precipitation recharges an aquifer, right? I mean, recharge by itself doesn't mean that you can use it apart from the water well. You're saying that a common sense plain meaning ruling of the word recharge means it's being put back in as if it were snow melt, as if it were rain, as if it were a water supply that is made available to all water users that have a right to that pool of water.
That's right, and that's exactly what it was about. It was about to put the water back in, and it would be a shared benefit to all of the water users within the basin. Now, one of the things that you will see today is this map behind me. This map was prepared by other council, and it doesn't show the other wells. It only shows the Cherokee wells. There are other people who are dependent on this recharge, whether it's natural or whether it's from the wastewater return. One of them is a gentleman whose wells are right in the vicinity of these Cherokee wells. His name is Dan Farmer. His last name really is Farmer. He's in the courtroom today. And if this court affirms Judge Schwartz's decision, he will be greatly injured by that. If it doesn't, then Mr. Farmer and others whose wells are in that vicinity will share the benefit with Cherokee. They won't lose all benefit from the recharge. Their wells that are in that area will benefit from a healthy aquifer that can sustain the pumping. So it's not an all or nothing proposition for them. And at the time when Mr. Lawrence, who represented Upper Black Squirrel, negotiated that, that was the point. And it wasn't inconsistent with positions they had taken before. These same Sweetwater water rights were the subject of an entity named Hydro Transfer. Hydro Transfer sold them, and somehow they wound up with Cherokee. Maybe there were some intervening users. But Hydro Transfer came before the Upper Black Squirrel Commission and sought the right to export too. And when they sought that right, it was granted with a lower amount of export if the water was not going to be returned to the basin, and a much higher amount of export if it was going to be returned to the basin. So this consistent desire to have the return flows come back to the basin and recharge the aquifer was true in Hydro Transfer. Now that order was ultimately rescinded and became null because Hydro Transfer didn't comply with the financial obligation they had with the district. So when Cherokee got these wells purchased then, they no longer had an export order. They had to start all over again and come back and get the right to export. So this was a consistent statement. It was a consistent position. And it was also recognized by the then state engineer, Mr. Simpson. The law required that if there was going to be this kind of activity by a district to provide water, they had to get some kind of consultation letter from the state engineer. And in that letter, which is in the record, the state engineer points out that the UBS district is going to want the return flows returned to the basin and says in his letter, and so it's a good thing that you're going to do that because that's what they're going to want. So this pattern of wanting to protect the return flows, to protect the recharge, it's consistent throughout the state, and it's not different here. This is what the UBS basin is legislatively charged with doing, and it's what they consistently did. I want to address briefly an argument that was raised in the briefs about the 1991 RTC stipulation. It was a prior case, 88 CW 49. It was a diligence case. Now, turning back again to principles of contract construction, what this court is to do de novo is try to discern what did the parties mean by this language at the time. As I said, Judge Mays heard this argument first and ruled in favor of UBS. This argument about the prior 1991 RTC stipulation wasn't raised by Cherokee at all. They didn't bring it up. Apparently they didn't think it didn't occur to them, and so we can surmise that it wasn't part of what they intended at the time. This argument about the 1990 RTC stipulation only came up after it was remanded and Meridian got into the case, proceeded to obviously do their homework, dig through the files, and they said, well, what about this? So I don't think it gives much credence to what Cherokee and UBS thought, because Meridian isn't a party to this stipulation, but nonetheless, it's argued in the case. So in arguing this, you do find the words, these water rights are not to be limited as a result of artificial recharge or reuse of return flows. And they make the argument that that was incorporated into the later stipulation. Well, it's not mentioned at all in the 1990 stipulation before the court. It's referenced in the decree. But the difference here is that when that RTC stipulation was made, it was a diligence case, there was no line of export whatsoever. Those water rights were to be used only in the basin. And as we've talked about here, when the water rights are used in the basin, the return flows do replenish the aquifer, and that was an important consideration. Later, when the right to export was sought by Cherokee, then the negotiation occurred over a course of months. A lot of those letters are in the record, and you can read them. It is clear Mr. Lawrence continues to insist repeatedly that they are not going to settle that case, that diligence case, and allow export unless the return flows aren't brought back into the basin. It's consistent. And Mr. Sussman, in fact, on behalf of Cherokee, agrees with that in one of his letters. He says it will greatly benefit the basin because we've acquired the interest in a pipeline that will allow us to return that water to the basin. So the RTC stipulation, I think, even though it's referenced in the decree with respect to the limitations of pumping, it's not fully incorporated, it is within the area where the limitations are being listed. Limitation on quantities, the limited diversions, all of that. So none of the behavior of the parties in the letters, in the prior cases, support the notion that somehow by their silence and by saying you can't do anything else with the water, that UBS would have all at all consented to a complete depletion of this huge amount of water.
Well, the stipulation we're looking at has to do with export from the basin, right?
That's right. It has to do with the settlement of a number of claims, and it says the wastewater returns. It's only paragraph 5 we're talking about here. The wastewater returns have to be returned to the basin in order to replenish the aquifer, to recharge the aquifer. That's what you're looking at. So, you know, it's somewhat convoluted argument about this 1991 stipulation, but I don't think it's very helpful because it doesn't help us try to figure out what the parties intended at the time. I'm going to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
You may do so. Thanks.
Madam Chief Justice, members of the court, I represent Cherokee Metropolitan District, and we serve about 18,000 people east of the UBS, and this is the Cherokee Metropolitan District over here. It is directly east of the city of Colorado Springs. This outlining in black here is the UBS district. The yellow on the district is the alluvium flows within the black swirl. This black UBS flows from north to south and exits at about, directly into Fountain Creek, and there slides south into Port Pueblo. We have here a water treatment facility at the south end, and the water treatment facility pumps wastewater or treated water back toward the wells. And these are the southern wells of the Sweetwater District. And Cormier Farmer Farmer's a soulless squatter to begin with, his family. So it's not, you know, he's not exactly a victim of any kind of gerrymandering metropolitan district. This will probably go down as Cherokee number four, but in, those of you who are here for Cherokee number one will recall that the dispute there was over the stipulation as it relates to wells 1 through 8. These were wells that were fully exportable at the time. And this area in the northern part of the district had significant problems with overutilization. And it was highly stressed. And as set forth in Cherokee number one, the core principle, the core proposal was that we, Cherokee, would not use this water or export the water except for emergency purposes. And that Cherokee would have the right to export the water, the sweet water wells, and to maximize the utilization of these wells as to the extent possible. These wells to the south are trying to capture, or the idea was to try to capture, the water that was leaving the district.
Oh, okay, we are talking about the Sweetwater water rights.
Right.
Okay, so what gives the right to reuse the return flows in the original decree for the Sweetwater rights?
There's no right in the original decree. What we do have, other than we have, we believe that under the law, as it relates to foreign water, once this water is plunging, once it leaves the district, it is foreign water. And to the extent we're pumping it back in, we believe that we have the right to reuse that water until it is exhausted. And that is an issue that will ultimately have to be decided by the Groundwater Commission, which is where we are staying from proceeding at this point.
But prior appropriation law doesn't allow a right to reuse water, does it? Unless it's decreed for reuse?
Well, we're going after the decree. That's the whole purpose of the replacement plan. That's pending in front of the water. That's not the issue that's before the court.
Well, the issue is what this stipulation means.
The issue is what the stipulation means. And the stipulation refers to essentially artificial recharge of the basin. It does not refer to rain. Artificial recharge is actually a term that's used in the 1991 stipulation that was incorporated into the decree that adopted the stipulation. And it specifically says in the decree, by incorporating that 1991 provision, that Cherokee has the right, or its prior owner had the right, to continue to use the water and to apply for a water right with respect to the additional water that was artificially recharged into the basin. Artificial recharge is used in that decree. It's in that stipulation. And it became part of the law of this case.
But artificial recharge in the Park County case means water that you have legally appropriated. Right? What about that? We've already seen that
our
case.
Water, we have, we're using the water that we have already appropriated, but we have a right of reuse, and we have a right to ask the Groundwater Commission for the right to declare as an additional replacement credit.
Well, but you invoked a term of art, artificial recharge, which is in the recharge statutes, having to do with water for which you have a legal right to have appropriated within the appropriation system. So I'm having trouble saying how this stipulation that refers to recharge in any way talks about artificial recharge, but if it is artificial recharge, you have to show under the Park County case that you have a right to that water, which you are attempting to gain credit for extraction, replacement, augmentation, etc.
And that is something that we'll have to show to the commission.
But you're trying to read that into the stipulation?
No, I'm not reading that. That is in the stipulation.
That's in the 1991?
In black and white.
Okay.
Letters, it's there.
But you don't have the right decree yet to do this.
Not yet. And this court didn't deal with that issue. As Justice Coates indicated, the court only resolved the issue of the plain meaning of the word recharge in the context of this particular case. That's all it did. That's the only issue in front of this court. Now, they tried, the other side tried to manufacture and twist things in such a way as to present a much grander case than it is before the court. But fundamentally, the sole purpose, the sole issue in front of this case is what is the meaning of the word recharge in this particular stipulation. That's all that there is. That's all the court decided. The court specifically said below that I am not making any decision with respect to what you have to present to the Water Commission. He's saying you may or may not have any rights. That's not what I'm trying to decide here. All I'm trying to decide is what is the word, meaning of the word recharge. Yeah. And you know, if you were trying to recharge this basin, where what would do any good, you'd specifically be negotiating for where you're going to put the water. Up here, not down here where it's going into the Spotton Creek. Doesn't make any sense. This was an add-on provision in the stipulation that was not contentious. And it was added in the last couple of days before the decree was decided, or the agreement or the stipulation was agreed to. It's essentially a stocking stuffer. Nobody thought it was anything that was a big issue, because from the district's point of view, they have an obligation by statute to maximize the beneficial use of the water. And by for us pouring $30 million into recharging this facility so that we can get some more effort and efficiency in the management of the water in this basin for the benefit of not only the basin but also the 18,000 people here in the Cherokee Metropolitan District, we're all serving the same benefit. If you take the word recharge, it has many synonyms: refill, reload, freshen, top off. Whether you're pouring it into water into a glass, whether you're pouring water into a bucket or a basin, in none of those circumstances and in none of those synonyms is there the concept built in of the idea of relinquishment. Relinquishment is not part of the concept of recharge. And if you are able or take the position that this particular case can be utilized to remove or divest water rights, which we estimate to be in the area of or value of about $10 million, on the basis of this feeble subjective implication, then you're dropping a rock into the concept of water rights and the value of water rights in this state that is would have drastic and considerable results. The rock hard principle of water rights in the state of Colorado is their value, and they are not easily and by this kind of implication, divested. Thank you.
All right, thank you. So we're going to now switch to you, Mr. Schroeder, is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, thank you.
Chief Justice Rice, members of the court, good morning. My name is Wayne Schroeder. I represent Meridian Service Metropolitan District. Justice Coates, you asked what the trial judge did, and he didn't say we have a right to get credit for each other. He just didn't say that at all. He said you can go back to the commission, and sooner or later you'll get that decision probably. His point was, and his order was, that the stipulation here does not preclude Meridian or Cherokee from asking for the right to reuse the water. So he just let that issue open. He didn't rule on it. He left it open, and presumably sooner or later it might get resolved by the Groundwater Commission. There's been much discussion about various and sundry things. One that I'd like to address is the matter of what can you do with the water, Justice Hobbs, in a designated basin. The Groundwater Commission didn't designate the whole basin. The basin is a geographic area. Within the basin, the Groundwater Commission in 1967 heard maybe a week or so of trial. Some of the best water lawyers in the state were involved. At that time, the commission determined that the alluvial aquifer in the designated basin contains designated groundwater. It may have been asked to designate something other than the alluvial basin, but it didn't. Other groundwater commissions, that is, other groundwater designated basins, involve sometimes the designation of everything in the basin as designated groundwater. This one didn't. Your own decision picked that up in a footnote. It's sort of off the track of the argument, but since it's been brought up, I need to respond to it. In Upper Blacksboro Groundwater Management District versus GOSS, that's G-O-S-S, there's a footnote, as you wrote in footnote 16, I don't recall exactly what the number is, but it says in the footnote exactly what the Groundwater Commission did in 1968 when it made its decision. Trial was in 67, the decision came out in 68. Only the alluvial aquifer within the overall area known as the basin was designated to contain, well, designated groundwater. The rest, the judges didn't do anything with, or I'm sorry, the commissioners didn't do anything with. The point is important because we've heard argument now from counsel for UBS saying all the water in the district is subject to the principle that none of it can be used. That's, well, nuts. The designation of only the alluvial aquifer was made by the commission in 1968. You can look at your own decision to see that. Again, other designated basins are a little different. Sometimes, as I said, all the water in the
basin. Here's the question, though. Regardless of what's designated groundwater or what is tributary to the Arkansas River, that's the kind of water we're talking about, right?
That's the kind of water we're talking about. I can't hear all of what you said, Your
Honor. Yeah, we're talking about either tributary water to the Arkansas River or designated groundwater, correct?
We're talking about tributary water to the Arkansas River or designated groundwater or in the basin water.
Oh, what kind of
water? There's another category of water in the basin that's called Denver Basin water, and that's never been designated as designated groundwater. That water is Carl water, for example, that Meridian uses. That water, we believe, can be reused without any problem. But these questions, these points, have to be resolved by the Groundwater Commission, which leads me to the next point. Whether the commission or the courts get to decide that point. In this particular instance, the Upper Black Squirrel District suffered an adverse ruling by the commission. I quoted the adverse ruling in the brief for Meridian. Within a few months after the adverse ruling, UBS took the case to the water court, which had concluded its adjudication 10 years earlier. And this court said in the first, well, in one of the cases, the last one, it's Cherokee 2, this court said that the commission itself has the right to determine, we think anyway, what the water rights involved in the basin are. That matter has already been resolved. We need to take the case to the commission to get the rest of the ruling done, but involved in that process is going to be more argument about the water court decrees. So we don't want to go back to the commission and have the commission give UBS possibly another adverse ruling, which UBS is going to take it to the nearest water court to have the issue resolved. Somebody has to determine what these water rights are and how they can be used. So far, we've got a water judge stepping in and claiming exclusive jurisdiction to adjudicate a contract. That all we have before the court is a contract dispute. Parties, according to this court, and as far as I know, most other courts, have determined that you can write a stipulation into a decree, and the stipulation then is going to be treated as a contract matter. So initially, the court needs to apply contract law. At that point, we need to find out if the contract is ambiguous. I don't think that UBS preserved the right to argue that, as it does, that you need to send this court back so that all these letters can be re-examined. They did not ask the court to make a finding of ambiguity, for example. And I think that's a key to their preservation of the right to bring that court to you. If they are complaining about a particular point, at the very least, they ought to tell the trial judge what they're complaining about. They did not at any time ask the court to make a finding of ambiguity. In the first case that we call Cherokee 1 versus Simpson, the trial judge, at that time also Judge Mace, made a deliberate finding of ambiguity. After he made the finding of ambiguity, a raft of evidence came in. And upon the basis of the raft of the evidence, one party lost, the other party didn't. But in this case, to distinguish it from Cherokee 1, there was no finding of ambiguity. It's my proposition, which I ask that you consider, it's my proposition that in order to argue to this court that the trial judge messed up or erred when he read this decree, and that he necessarily had to take into consideration all of these other letters, affidavits, and so forth, it's my proposition that they have to call that to the attention of the judge before they can preserve that for appellate review. That wasn't done yet.
Counsel, can I ask you a question about that? It looks to me like Judge Schwartz did deal with this whole question of ambiguity and found, in his opinion, that nothing in terms of what had been submitted to him, either affidavits or the correspondence.
He did look at other documents.
Yeah, gave meaning to the stipulation. And so he resorted instead to the plain language and made a plain language determination.
He resorted, Your Honor,
to plain language.
He resorted to the plain language of the stipulation, and he said the plain language of the stipulation doesn't mean that recharge means what Upper Waxville says it means, that's all. The stipulation has been referred to now a number of times. It's been quoted, I think, in all the briefs, but I'm referring now to the opening brief of Meridian. It says here on page 10, paragraph 10 of the 1999 stipulation provides that in case 88CW49, there was a stipulation that the annual diversion from all of the seawater absolute and conditional decrees would not exceed 10,000 acre feet annually. This stipulation remains in full force and effect, and in addition thereto, the applicant has stipulated as follows. And then we get to paragraph 2 of that stipulation. This is the underlying language. In addition, the stipulation, for recharge that is, shall not be construed as a limitation on the right to withdraw additional quantities of water lawfully available to these water rights as a result of the artificial recharge of aquifer, as a result of the recapture and or reuse of return flows resulting from the exercise of the water rights. The judge below, Judge Schwartz, relied on this language for the proposition that their view, the UBS view of what recharge means, doesn't mean that at all, because the parties had explicitly agreed in the stipulation, which is incorporated into the into the decree. They agreed that the parties would not be precluded from claiming additional water. So the question again, who gets to decide what the claim is, how much it is, whether it's valid or not? We'd like to have the case go back. We'd like to have the preliminary injunction lifted. The trial court and Meridian got involved in a contest over whether the preliminary injunction should be lifted. It's been in effect since 1999. The argument made to the court was that judges shouldn't be enjoining administrative agencies. That's not what you do. There should be no injunction against the administrative agency. In a couple of instances, injunctions have been issued where the administrative agency is way in excess of its jurisdiction. Here, there's no question that this administrative agency was doing what it's supposed to do. The only thing UES didn't like was a ruling that said their interpretation isn't going to be the interpretation that the court is going to use. So we'd like to have somehow this court address the jurisdictional question and at the same time eliminate the preliminary injunction, which the judges so far since 1999 have declined to do. Chief Justice Rice, in a case called Southern Indian Ute Tribe versus King Consolidated Ditch or something like that, you wrote a dissenting opinion joined in by two other justices saying generally you can't use a declaratory judgment action in a water court proceeding. It just doesn't fit anywhere. There is no due process afforded to the people who are affected, such as Meridian. In this instance, Meridian was enjoined and didn't even know it had been enjoined until, of course, the care workers eventually served on it. But there is an issue that the court needs to resolve, namely whether in the course of a water act proceeding, the Declaratory Judgment Act can be stuck in and employed. In this case, there was no notice of any kind to Meridian. We just got an order after a while saying, guys, you've been enjoined. In the Southern Ute case, there was notice by publication. The dispute in the Southern Ute case, which was established a year or so ago, was whether publication under the Water Rights Act was sufficient to give notice. Four judges said yes, three judges said no, that case was not available in the early proceedings of this particular adjudication. It just hadn't been decided yet. But we brought to the attention of the court early on the proposition that the declaratory judgment proceeding doesn't work here because there's been no service. In the words of this court in Cherokee 2, UBS reopened a case that's your words, reopened a case that had been finally adjudicated 10 years earlier. No notice given, no resume notice given, no personal notice given, nothing was given. The court undertook itself to start the process over again. That's what we asked the court to review. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you, Mr. Sherman. So, you have some time left for some fun.
Yeah, there's a fire in this courtroom. A few statements. First of all, I want to make a few statements about this map. This map is not useful to try to determine what the parties meant by paragraph 5 in the stipulation, which is what's before us. This map was never presented to the trial court, either Judge Mays or Judge Schwartz. It was not in any evidence in the correspondence between the parties at all. So it wasn't used in the course of negotiation. And further, the groundwater contours, which is some expert's view of what's going on underground between water and geology, that's shown here, and that's what those yellow wavy lines are, the groundwater contours, are a subject of expert opinion. They've not been to trial. They've not been countered by another expert, and there's been no determination about whether they're right or wrong. So I don't think this map helps
determine the fundamental question before the court, which is what did the parties intend by paragraph 5 at all? There's something that answers the question, and there's a lot of problems with it. So enough of that. As to the question of whether or not paragraph 5 was thrown into the stipulation, quote, at the last minute, as some kind of stocking stuffer, the evidence in the record clearly shows that that's not true. And I want to cite two letters which are in the record to the court. One is a letter of December 1st, 1998. It is from Mr. Lawrence, who's representing the Upper Blacksburg District, to Ken Knox, who was then the assistant state engineer and was trying to serve as somewhat of a mediator between the parties. This letter was attached to the motions for summary judgment by both parties, actually. And what the letter says in paragraph number one under issues halfway down, it says, one of the issues is the district objects to the export of that water with no requirement or commitment to recharge and return flows to help preserve the water rights in the basin. That was in December of 1998, so it wasn't thrown in at the last minute. That was Mr. Lawrence's letter. Another document I will bring to the court's attention, which is in the record, is an affidavit of Mr. Susno in July of 1998.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, because I know you're on a roll there, but I want to ask you the same question. What about Judge Schwartz's finding that none of these affidavits or letters were of any value to him?
I agree with the first water judge, Judge Mace. The term recharge the aquifer is something that in water law, you know, when we read it, just as I read the opinion in my opening statements, we know what that means. It means you put it in, it helps benefit the aquifer, it preserves the return flows to support the water rights of others. So if I were the water judge, I would say that recharge the aquifer is not ambiguous. I do understand that Judge Schwartz looked at these things, didn't find them particularly helpful, kind of threw up his hands and said, well, it doesn't say they can't do this, so I guess they can.
What's interesting is, what's interesting is he found it not ambiguous, but I think he disagreed with Judge Mays. Is that right?
He did disagree with Judge Mays.
Both of them, looking at the plain language, came up with a different interpretation. What happened?
That is what happened. Oh. And that is why in my opening statement, and maybe I didn't make it clear enough, I said all the parties agree that this is a de novo review. We have one water judge who was the water judge for some time who looked at it and said, I know what that means. I don't need to look at all the background. Then on remand after this court allowed the intervention of Meridian, the first judge had retired. We had a new judge who looked at it and said, well, I'm not sure I know what it means. He didn't hold any hearings. They were cross motions for summary judgment and affidavits. And attached to that were a lot of these letters, and most of the same letters from both parties supporting their positions. And maybe that's what kind of frustrated, is that each party cited different parts of the letters, and he finally resorted to, well, what is the plan?
You got a problem here, though. So okay. What does the stipulation, other stipulation, the other stipulation, reserving the rights to claim the reuse water? What does that mean? Why is it not effective?
It's not effective because that was before any right to export the water occurred. It was a diligence case. It was not an absolute water right case. It was solely a diligence case. The RTC had taken in the assets of that prior entity, and they were trying to preserve everything they could think of. That was their job. But it was without the right of export, and it was a diligence case. It wasn't an absolute case. When you read the actual decree in the 1999-1998 proceeding, I think it was entered in 1999, you see a brief reference, and of course it's in my pile of notes over there, but you see a reference to the volumes of water in the section where it has all the limitations, and it says those volumes, and that's when it refers to the 99 decree, and then the 91 stipulation. It should have said that provision of the 91 stipulation is fully incorporated herein. It doesn't say that, it says the stipulation. But I think the fundamental problem is there wasn't a right to export then. And in fact, Mr. Susno was sued because apparently his clients didn't know that and he didn't advise them of that. So the language of that 91 stipulation doesn't apply now at all. In conclusion, I want to make a couple of points.
One is, this is not a good policy case. This is not to undermine the value of water rights around the state. This is really between these parties, the fight over what does paragraph 5 mean. So I don't think this is a huge policy case that's going to shake the timbers of water rights we know it. The issue in the replacement plan that Judge Schwartz referred to is, you know, they will have to prove in the replacement plan time, place, and amount so that they don't injure other water rights. But the question is, can they use these sweet water rights that are not decreed for augmentation and replacement as a one-on-one? This court needs to reverse Judge Schwartz, say the interpretation is clear that you don't have to list everything you can do. Use of fractionary rights are you are given the rights that you claim and that the court finds you need in the amounts that you need. It's not a 100% pass on all of that. And what UBS requests is that the court enforce that paragraph just as it is written, that you don't insert additional beneficial uses because they are not stated here as being precluded. Beneficial uses are being positively stated and can have limitations on them, such as quantity and time and other things. So I thank the court for your time and attention today. If you don't have any other questions, I'm concluding.
Looks like we're good. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So I want to thank everyone for their arguments, Ms. Montagna, Mrs. Fichet, and Mr. Schroeder. We appreciate it. This case will be taken under advisement.